If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Thursday, June the 14th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow. Our guest today in the Hoover Studio, deep in the heart of Stanford University's campus, is Dr. David Brady. He is the Davies Family Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. He also holds the Bowen H. and Janice Arthur McCoy Professor of Political Science and the Graduate School of Business at Stanford. David Brady has been on continual appointment at Stanford University since 1986, which, Dave, is 32 years or 9 midterm elections, which is what we're going to talk about today. June 14th is, of course, National Flag Day, commemorating the adoption of the U.S. flag in the state in 1777. It's also a notable birthday. Actually, it's a personal birthday in my family. Dave, about an hour ago, I became a great-uncle for the second and third times.
Congratulations.
A shout-out to my niece, Lauren Maxwell, who lives in Greenville, South Carolina, with her husband, Mills.
And I want your audience to know that I was not born in 1777.
Okay. But my niece, Lauren, and my nephew, Mills, they're now the proud parents of twin boys. On a very funny side note, my niece Lauren does not like Donald Trump. Not a fan of Donald Trump. And June 14th today, Dave, is Donald Trump's 72nd birthday. So I'm trying to figure how in the next few days to sort of let her know that her children are born on the same day as the president who she does not like.
Send her the podcast.
Exactly. So it's too late to get President Trump a birthday present, but if there's one gift he would like this year, other than Robert Mueller vanishing off the face of the earth, would be the return of a Republican-controlled Congress in 2019. Dave, this is not an easy task. In part, history is staring him square in the face. You'll go back to the Obama presidency, the Bush 43 presidency, and the Clinton presidency, and there is a trend. The president enters office with both chambers of Congress. He then leaves office having lost both chambers of Congress. In some cases, it's done in rather quick, spectacular fashion, like Clinton in 1994, where he loses both chambers. With Bush, he loses both chambers in his second midterm election, his sixth year in office. Obama splits the difference. Obama loses the House in 2 years. He loses the Senate in year six. I'm going to read you, Dave, something that Stuart Rothenberg wrote in Roll Call the other day, and I want to get your thoughts on this. Here's what Stuart wrote, and if you don't know Stuart Rothenberg, listeners, he is a Republican pollster. Mr. Rothenberg wrote, quote, "There is abundance of evidence that House Democratic House prospects are as good as they have been for months, and the House is very likely to flip." Dave, here's what he cites as reasons behind this statement. Number one, midterms have almost always been about the president. 23 Republicans sit in districts carried by Hillary Clinton, so we assume Donald Trump is the bullseye in those 23 districts. Second, Donald Trump's job approval ratings, Rothenberg describes them as, quote, mediocre at best. Point three, Democrats are angry and energized, as demonstrated by high-profile recent elections in Virginia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. Point four, GOP House retirements mean fewer incumbents who would be better prepared to swim against the tide. Mark Sanford, Dave, lost in South Carolina on Tuesday. That makes 45 GOP incumbents who are not coming back next year, either of their own volition or the voters' choosing. And then the final Rothenberg point, Dave, voters see the midterms as an opportunity to check Trump. Collectively, he says this is a formula for a substantial Democratic House gain and control of the chamber next year. What say you?
So I wrote in a Hoover publication, Defining Ideas, maybe a month ago, something similar to that, a little less sure that that would be the case. But I would say that in the last month since I looked at the data and published that, mm-hmm. Making the same points about the number of retirements. Retirements are strategic. Congressmen and women decide to retire when it looks like they're going to have a tougher campaign or that they might lose. The enthusiasm gap appeared to be on the Democratic side. The generic ballot appeared to be on the Democratic side, 8, 10, 12 points in some surveys. And finally, the historical point that presidents with low ratings in the 40s don't do so well. I would have to revise that today. President Trump has been rising in the polls. His approval ratings are higher than they had. They're as high as they were when he started the presidency. And if you break that down, Democrats didn't like Trump from the get-go. Republicans did, but he fell off a little bit, but he's back up with 83% or 84% approval among Republicans. Mm-hmm. And independents have divided. Now they're back up, a little more supportive. Men who are independents support him. Women who are independents don't support him, but both have been rising lately. The economy is in terrific shape. The number of people who say he's doing well in the economy is quite high. So what you mentioned was wave elections. That right. is 1994, 2006, and 2010. Those are wave elections, and by that you mean sort of there's a wave and the other party is swept out.
Right.
If the election were held tomorrow, I would say it would not be a wave election. So not only is Trump, not only is the economy good, Trump's approval ratings are moving in the right direction. That's not to say people like Trump, just they're starting to approve of the policies. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing I would say is the generic ballot is back down to about 4 or 5%. Mm-hmm. And in addition, that enthusiasm measure is hard to actually measure enthusiasm. Right. So for me, it's a question of turnout. And the turnout, if Democrats turn out more than Republicans, then they could take it back. Mm-hmm. And if independents who don't like Trump turn out. But we don't know. It's hard to predict turnout. And right. I guess what I would say is if this election was held today, it would not be a wave election, which means, and I'm going to turn this back to you at this point, if it's not a wave election,
right.
that means the Democrats could take the House.
Right.
It means they slog it out district by district. They got 23 seats to make up. Right. They're going to pick some up in Pennsylvania. Who knows about California? So at this point, if I had to choose, I'd choose this is a slog out election. And that means instead of looking at the wave and what's the anti-Trump thing, it means you look at individual districts and individual contests.
Right.
And so on that, I wanted to, one reason I wanted to do the podcast was get your opinion of California, where the Democrats have to take 4 or 5 seats.
Right.
Otherwise, I think they can't take 23.
Right. So they need 23 in all. There were 23 districts, Dave, that voted for Hillary Clinton and a Republican member of Congress. 7 of those are in California, 2 in Florida, 2 in Pennsylvania, and the rest are scattered to the four winds. So California's the beginning of things. I'm going to get into the math of this in a minute, but let's close out on what you just said. Let's define a little more closely what wave means. Does wave mean actually sweeping into power? Is there a numerical value to wave of 20, 30, 40 seats? How do you define, quote unquote, wave?
I define a wave election where the switch from the previous election, mm-hmm. the previous House election,
right.
or the presidential, is sort of universal. It moves, right. that is, there's a force moving it.
Right.
So in 2010, that force was people who had voted for Obama for one reason mm-hmm. and then thought he was too liberal and they didn't like the Affordable Care Act. That
right.
moved against him. In 2006, the Iraq War had been won, but not won really, and there was all the Iraq activity. Bush had tried to privatize Social Security in a bill. That wave and the account worked against him. And in 1994, it was against Clinton and people who'd supported Clinton's liberal policies.
Right.
Data show that. So for me, a wave, I don't define it so much by how many, although you'd have to say 25, 30 would be a minimum.
Right.
But a wave is an election that's about something and people are reacting to it in a single direction. And one last thing I'd say on that, wave elections for Republicans are much bigger than they are for Democrats.
Right.
And that's because Democrats are, the way that's normally put in the press, mm-hmm. They say, well, Democrats are concentrated in urban areas, et cetera.
Right.
What they never say is there are between, you know, 55 and 70-some majority-minority districts.
Right.
Those districts are overwhelmingly Democrat, and that's fine if you want to make sure you have African Americans and Latinos in Congress. That's fine with me. But when you do that, you give the Republicans some advantages. So Democrats I think 30, 35 is kind of the max they can get out of any election, whereas we know from 2010 and 1994, Republicans can go into the 60s.
Right, a little history. So in 1994, the Republicans gained 54 House seats. In 2010, the Republicans picked up 63 House seats. In 1982, the Democrats picked up 26 House seats. The regaining of the House in 2006, then building on that, was a two-step phase for Democrats in 2006, 2008. So you're right, Dave. They don't pick up in the same large gulf that Republicans do. Maybe market correction is another way to look at this. If you look at the Obama midterm of 2010, you can argue part of the haul of 63 House seats was a handful of seats that just ordinarily do not vote Democratic, but,
exactly right.
but corrected with the market in 2010. All right, so if you're listening out to this and you really want to get into the math of this, I'm about to throw a bunch of numbers at you, so get out a piece of paper and a pen and start writing this down. So here we go. You look at the 435 House seats are up right now, and I'm working off the Cook Political Report, if those are listening or want to go look into this. Cook Political Report ranks House seats in several categories. They do solid seats, meaning that one party just controls its district, and even if the person dies, they're going to get reelected. They then have what are called likely lean districts, which means that in all odds, unless there's something really unusual, the party's going to carry that district. It then has toss-up or worse, which is self-explanatory. So here's how Cook breaks it down, Dave. 435 total. Cook gives 180 solid seats to Democrats. So Democrats start with 180, 157 solid Republican seats. So 180 to 157, but category two, likely lean seats. There are only 12 likely lean Democratic seats. There are 54 likely lean Republican seats. So add that up and you get a total of 192 seats for the Democrats, 211 for the Republicans. So they're only seven shy of where they need to be, 218 and getting over the top. But here's where this election will keep us up late at night on election day. Toss up and worse. There are only three Democratic seats right now, Dave, that are rated toss up or worse. Mm-hmm. 29 Republican seats are rated toss-up or worse. Yep. So, very simple for the Democrats. If they have 192 seats that are either theirs or pretty likely to be theirs, they have to go out and find what? Another 26 seats. That means they have to win 26 out of 32 seats that are up for grabs, meaning they have to have a pretty great night. They have to run the table.
I think that means in order to win, they'd have to get 55% of the vote. I don't think at this point they have it. And if you take a seat as a toss-up, and it means a toss-up, it means you flip a coin.
Right.
And if you do that and the seats split 50-50 or even a little more, 55-45, that means the Republicans retain control of the House. Right. That's why I now say that so the point of looking at the Cook things is that's you got to look at those 29 districts.
Right.
You're not looking at a wave anymore. You're talking about who's running in those districts, how are they running, who has the best chance, et cetera.
Right. Now, this is a great segue now into California, since you asked. Of the seven seats, there are 14 Republican seats in all in California, 14 out of 53. The other 39 are Democratic. Back in the day, when I worked for Pete Wilson in the 1990s, it was pretty much split between Republicans and Democrats, but that's been part of the great Republican recession in California, down to only 14 seats. Seven are targeted by the Democrats. If you look at Tuesday night's results, Dave, the Republicans and the Democrats both kind of got what they want. For the Democrats, the main thing they got was they did not get shut out of any districts. Under the California top two system, you can send a Republican and a Democrat to the November election. You can send two Democrats or two Republicans. The Democratic fear was that in a couple of Southern California districts that they would get boxed out. That didn't happen. They broke through. But the Republicans got some things, too. So let me walk you through a few districts, Dave, and explain what went down. Probably the most closely watched district in California is the 39th Congressional District. It's being vacated by Ed Royce, longtime Republican congressman. It covers parts of Orange County, Los Angeles County, and San Bernardino. It's kind of a hodgepodge of Southern California. The Democrats got what they wanted. They got a Navy veteran philanthropist named Gil Cisneros into the runoff. So they got their guy.
And he's got money, too, right?
Right, and he's got money.
He won the lottery.
Right, so they have a shot at that. In the 48th Congressional District, the Democrats did a very smart thing. They boosted a minor GOP candidate named John Gabbert. They put money into him. Why did they put money into him? He got about 3.5% vote. That was enough to keep a second Republican from getting onto the ballot with Dana Rohrabacher, the incumbent, the troubled incumbent. in the 49th Congressional District, Dave, the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. They went after a Republican, Assemblyman Rocky Chavez, who's been eyeing that seat for a long time, drove down his numbers. And it drove up instead a Republican named Diane Harkey, who sits on the Board of Equalization. They think she's vulnerable. So they got what they wanted. Republicans, on the other hand, they got a woman running in the 39th CD, Assemblywoman named Young Kim. Very attractive young candidate, so she's on the ballot. They're happy about that. In some other districts, they got the Democrat they wanted, in particular in the 45th Congressional District. That's occupied by Mimi Walters.
Right.
She is a freshman Republican. If you think about this as a great herd going across the African savannah, she, as a freshman, she's kind of the smallest member of the herd. She's the most vulnerable. But she got as their opponent a pro-single-payer consumer advocate by the name of Katie Porter. So what did Mimi Walters do a couple of days after the election? She started blitzing single-payer care ads across her district. Why? Single-payer care, and your colleague Narismo Fiorina has been on top of this. A funny thing about this is going to be very much a part of the California conversation, I think, in November. Gavin Newsom, who's running for governor, big advocate of single-payer care. The California Nurses Association supports him. They are a very noisy, militant band of nurses. They will hold his feet to the fire on this. If I'm running against Gavin Newsom, I'm going to make this an issue. Why? Look at the polls. A slim majority of Californians like single-payer care. When you ask them, do you like this? 53%, according to one poll, say, yeah, we like it. And then you rephrase the question saying, okay, do you want to have this if you have to pay taxes? That support, Dave, falls down close to 40%. So the bottom falls out of it. So common sense, if I'm a Republican running against Governor Newsom or a Republican running against a congressional candidate, I'm going to make this an issue, ask them simply how they want to pay. So I think one thing which unites Californians is quality of health care when you start talking about Medicare for all. So you look at this, Dave, and it's hard to look at this landscape at present and say, yes, Democrats are going to bat 7 for 7 in these races. They might get 2, 3, 4 of these seats, but I don't see how they get 7. So if they don't get the 7, they've got to go find 3 or 4 elsewhere.
Yeah, and they got to have, it seems to me they have to have 4. One interesting fact about those 14 seats, you think with all the seats California has, the Republican delegation is almost nothing.
Right.
But those 14 Republicans in California are more Republicans than in 46 other states.
They
are. It's a huge delegation.
And this is another complicating fact of California politics. Donald Trump is very unpopular statewide. He polls at about 30% statewide. He got, I think, 31.9 in the 2016 election.
You're not talking about the poll that Hoover did with American West, Center for the West.
Right. I'm talking about the IGS poll out of Cal Berkeley, the PPIC poll.
And these are your the questions you put on the districts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So he weighs in around 30% in these polls. But don't look at California as a sum. Look at it as parts of the sum. And consider the parts of the sums, his congressional districts. Whereas Trump is at 30% statewide, Dave, he's running closer to 45 to 50% inside these Republican districts. So two factors kick in. Number one, how hard, if you're a Democrat, do you bash Donald Trump? Because what we've seen in this election is the Democrats are modulating their message. They have what they call a better deal. This was very economically driven as of a couple months ago, and I think they've come to the conclusion that maybe running in the economy is not a smart thing because the economy is generally working for people. So they've tried to adjust their message, and they're making it more of Washington culture and very personal against Donald Trump. Well, if Trump is pushing closer to 50% in these districts, if, as you alluded to, he's doing some things as president, he's looking presidential in summits, the economy is moving along, maybe not a good strategy. And then the second factor to look at, Dave, is Donald Trump's involvement as well. We saw him get involved in the governor's race here in California, where he endorsed one of the Republican candidates, John Cox, which pretty much got him into second place. And what we saw on Tuesday in South Carolina was something pretty rare in presidential politics. A fellow named Mark Sanford is running for re-election. To those listeners who aren't familiar with Mr. Sanford, he was at one point the governor of South Carolina. He was very well lined up to run for president in 2012. And then what happens? He goes missing on the job. And his press secretary covers for him and claims that his boss is, what, hiking on the Appalachian Trail, when it turns out his boss was actually in Argentina, shacked up with his girlfriend, married at the time. Not good. So Governor Sanford has to come home, cop up to the affair, leaves his wife, and his career collapses. Well, we love a comeback in America, so sure enough, Mark Sanford runs for Congress. He runs in the Charleston district in South Carolina, which is a kind of interesting district.
Yeah.
It's more moderate than people would think. If you look at the presidential map, Hillary Clinton actually carried the so-called low country in South Carolina.
Right.
It's Republican, but kind of moderate Republicans, business Republicans for the most part, not great Trump fans. They were willing to give Mark Sanford a return to Washington, where he served a couple of terms. But then Mark Sanford, once Donald Trump was elected, Dave, he made a decision. He made a decision that he was going to oppose the president. And guess what? On Tuesday, in the primary, Donald Trump issued a tweet, very personal tweet, saying, don't vote for this guy, send him back to Argentina. Ouch. But what you saw, which is unique, Dave, I'll get your thoughts on this, a president engaging in Republican primaries, trying to pick winners and losers. Franklin Roosevelt tried this in 1938, got very involved in campaigns, went around the country, and got his hat handed to him as a result. But Donald Trump is doing this as well. He's trying to pick winners and losers.
Well, I mean, I think he has. He didn't try for as many as Roosevelt did in 38.
Right.
So I agree that about everything we're talking about, now notice that does point to a slog it out.
Yes.
It says it's district by district.
Right.
It goes against Sanford, and then there's the one in Alabama where the woman was against Trump, and now she's in a runoff.
Right.
And so it points to a dilemma that many Republican candidates for Congress wish they didn't have, which is they now see that they can't stray too far from the base because Trump is very popular with that base.
Right.
And yet in some districts, like the ones you talked about in California, they've got to have a few independents voting for them in order to – they can't have all the Democrats and all the independents voting against them. So I agree with your analysis of those. And the point is now we're talking about district by district.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about anti-Trump, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that could change. I think we should say that, or I'm going to say it. You can agree or disagree. But I think given Donald Trump, that could change in a minute. I mean, Korea could have gone badly. I think it went reasonably well for them. I'm not talking about the future. I'm talking about the politics of the next 6 months. But there's all sorts of things he could do between now and then. But at this point, if the election were held today, I think, and I talk with Doug Rivers, who's often on this with us, and he said it's closer to 50-50 than he thought it would be a month ago.
That's funny. I thought Doug was kind of bullish on the concept of a Democratic takeover, and that
he was.
That he actually thought the Democrats
He's
might
more
get up
bullish
in the
on it than I am, in the sense of that's what he thinks the data say,
right.
But less so than he thought last time he was on with you.
Right. Let me run this by you, Dave. Let's say the Republicans come back to power, but they're going to lose seats. And they have right now 240-plus seats in the House, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what if they get numbers down in the 220s? Or conversely, what if the Democrats come in, but again, because it's not the gigantic wave that they hope, but they still get enough to get the majority? Let's say they get 30 seats. They're in the 220s as well. How is either of these parties going to run the House when we see the Republicans struggling in the 240s? How are you going to run the House when your numbers are only in the 220s and you can at best lose maybe 10 members on a vote?
Well, I think you're exactly right. It'd be one thing you could say is, well, they won't get much done.
Right.
And that's not atypical for presidents to not get much done in their second term.
Mm-hmm.
The second part of their first term. However, I sort of agree with the Wall Street Journal and others who said, so suppose the Democrats take over narrowly.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know who will be Speaker. You'd have to bet on Pelosi. But there are, at my last count, 11 Democrats running who say they will, have made it a part of the campaign, say they won't vote for Pelosi. So, for example, in Indiana's 2nd District, the candidate there, Mel Hall, business guy, former minister, very successful guy, he's just made it a part of the campaign, I will not vote for Nancy Pelosi as Speaker.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, the Wall Street Journal pointed out, well, what if Trump comes up with a huge infrastructure plan? Would the Democrats vote for that? So it'll make it very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the most interesting part will be how will Trump react, and will Nancy and Chuck become his buddies again?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a possibility. This president moves around on that issue, and he said he wanted infrastructure. What will he do on what could he do on Social Security, things like that? I'm just not sure.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch how Democrats play Nancy Pelosi. Politico did a survey of something like 34, 36 Democrats running for the House out here in California. I think a handful, Dave, maybe four or five at the most, were willing to say on the record that they will vote for her as Speaker. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if they see a liability there. They just don't want to count their chickens, what have you. But there's something about her that causes a little reservation inside the party.
Yeah, I think that the Republicans are going to partially run against her.
Right.
She's quite unpopular in terms of the approval ratings. Republicans, I think, will rationally run against her. And some of them are, some Democrats are worried about that in the sense that could have got me. And they might actually want some change.
Yeah. Somebody else who's been very quiet in this election so far but could also step in and play a factor, Tom Steyer. In this regard, so Tom Steyer is a hedge fund billionaire sitting up in San Francisco, and he is the godfather of the website Need to Impeach. People scoff at what he is doing, but I would all I can say about that, go to the website, Dave. You'll find 6 million people who have signed online.
Yep.
So that could be 6 million people who could vote. It makes Steyer potentially a presidential player if he wants to. But there's nothing stopping Tom Steyer with his considerable resources from launching impeachment ads in battleground districts and forcing Democratic candidates to go on the record about impeachment. You go back to 2006, Dave, and look at what Pelosi did on impeachment. She played it rather masterfully.
Yes, she did.
John Conyers, at the time in line to become the next chairman of the Judiciary Committee, was telling reporters that he wanted to launch impeachment against Bush, basically saying he lied to Congress about Iraq. Well, Nancy Pelosi started hearing about this. She had a meeting with the caucus. They talked about it. And then she quickly went out to reporters. This was in May of 2006, well before November. And she went out to reporters and she said, in no uncertain terms, impeachment is off the table. Flash forward to 2018. And what is she doing? She is saying that, well, impeachment, and I don't know about impeachment. She doesn't take it off the table, but she doesn't want to embrace it either. So she's trying to have it both ways.
Yeah, there's 58 Democrats who've signed, House Democrats who've signed a thing and say if they get a majority, they'll absolutely introduce impeachment. And I think the Republicans are going to use that in the camp again. And that's an issue that might turn out the base. So in one sense, as you know, and better in California by far than me, is the turnout question.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to turn out? So, and just one example of that. In Virginia, I think the Virginia primary hurt Republicans in that the Republican Senate candidate, I think, is a little out there.
Right.
And I think that means, so we do know the following thing. Let me start again. We do know the following thing. That if it's just a House race, no matter how interesting it is, that does not gin up turnout.
Right.
But with a good Senate race or a gubernatorial race in the state, you gin up turnout.
Right.
And so the Senate race could have helped bring Republicans out in the key districts. But it looks like Kaine's going to win overwhelmingly, which means that'll probably repress Republican turnout.
Right.
So, again, going back to this state by state, district by district, that's the kind of analysis you're doing. And so California, as you say, lucked out because you got the number two, a Republican candidate. So that's not going to depress. If it were two Democrats, that certainly will repress Republican turnout.
Right.
So you got to look at each one of those things in each state. And again, the key is going to be turnout. We know Democrats are fired up.
Mm-hmm.
How many of these highly educated Republican women and educated women who say they're independent, how many of them are going to turn out and vote? And how many of them are there in the district? Each district differs.
Right. So Virginia has a fascinating congressional race in that regard, and that's Barbara Comstock, who represents a district just outside of Washington. This is suburban, exurban Northern Virginia. It is becoming an increasingly affluent district. As a Republican, she has a brand issue, and so she's at all times looking for kind of straws to grasp on. And to me, Dave, impeachment is kind of a classic example because a thinking person is going to look at impeachment and ask several questions. Number one, has Trump done anything impeachable? Well, you can't impeach somebody, I don't think, because you think they're a jerk. Well, maybe you can if you want to try, but the idea is it's a high crime or misdemeanor. He has to have committed some misdeed. So number one, what has he done that merits impeachment? But then secondly, since Bill Clinton remains fresh in the news, how would you like to be Bill Clinton's co-author, by the way?
Yeah.
You've written a book and you're trying to promote the book, and every time Bill Clinton goes out there, he just rehashes the events of 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Kill me now. But no, here's Barbara Comstock hoping, praying that impeachment becomes in because why? I think thinking people in her district, Dave, unaffiliated voters, people who don't like both parties and extremist actions by both parties, will look at that and they think, boy, we don't want to sign on to what ultimately will be a cul-de-sac, as it was with Clinton. Even if a Democratic House impeached the guy, a Senate that's going to be Republican or by some wild chance marginally Democratic, they're not going to get the two-thirds majority. It's just not going to happen. It's wheel spinning at its worst.
Right. And so I think the Democratic candidates there got to come out and say, I'm not going to vote for impeachment. Right. It's what the guy who won in the Senate seat in Alabama,
exactly.
and what the Lamb in Pennsylvania's 18th district.
Right.
They
got
to say that. But it does put them on the defensive.
Right.
Because they should be running the odds should be in their favor at this point, mm-hmm. particularly in the Comstock case.
Right.
And that puts the pressure back on them, and it's a different kind of race then.
Right. So California's interesting, Dave, in a couple regards. You mentioned having a Republican at the top of the ticket. I have a buddy who does polling for Republicans in Sacramento. He insists, and I think he's probably spinning me here, but he insists that without a Republican at the top of the ticket, Republican turnout falls down to about 58%. He claims with the Republican at the top of the ticket, it's closer to 80%. That sounds, 80 sounds a little generous given it's not a presidential election, but the point being that there is a gap.
Yeah. And even if you have it, it's still a lot.
Even if you have it, it's still a lot. Now, it's not going to make a difference perhaps the statewide race because Democrats have a 20% advantage in voter registration. Yeah. You would have to have a wild turnout among Republicans, a depressed Democratic turnout among Democrats, and you'd have to do just fantastically among non-affiliated voters. That's a very hard thing for a Republican to pull off, especially a guy like John Cox who doesn't have $50 or $100 million. He doesn't have Meg Whitman money to throw around here. But there is a turnout advantage. The other factor in California, Dave, is ballot initiatives. There is one ballot initiative which Republicans are going to try to latch on to, and that is the repeal of last year's gasoline tax. It adds 12 cents a gallon to your high test at the pump. So Republicans are going to try to ride on that ticket. And then there's a third factor that just popped up this week. I'm not sure if it's going to really materialize much in the fall. That is our friend Tim Draper. What has Tim Draper done? Tim Draper has qualified an initiative that would divide California into three parts.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I don't know if it's going to pass. Even if it passed, I don't think Congress is going to support the concept. But it's the kind of thing that might catch voters' attentions. And maybe it might start a bit of a conversation about what's wrong with California because Mr. Draper's contention is California is unmanageable, it's ungovernable, it's too big, it needs to be chopped up into three pieces. You get past the goofiness and the Daily Show factor of it, and there is a serious discussion to be had about the government of Sacramento and whether or not it's representative of the entire state. Combine those factors, and maybe that gives Republicans a better boost to congressional districts than we think.
Yeah, I think those are, again, the sorts of things that I think are going to make a difference. And I think in that way, it does make it harder for Democrats to get up to five of those seven seats.
Right. There is one other thing in California that's worth pointing out, Dave, and that is the Democrat at the top of the ticket, and that is Gavin Newsom.
Yep.
So Gavin Newsom, there's a competition in California at all times. When Donald Trump does something that is provocative, it's a competition as to which Democrat can tweet first. And Gavin Newsom is perhaps quickest on the draw when it comes to tweeting. He is fast at it. He's very good at it. His message is just very, very anti-Trump. He was bashing Trump in his victory night speech, for example.
Yep.
So there's a question of Newsom coming into Republican districts, if he so chooses, Dave, and bashing Trump. But the other question with Gavin, which is interesting, is how California will accept him writ large. It's interesting. When Jerry Brown came into office in 1974, before you got to California, Jerry Brown is elected governor the first time in 1974, and he is a vast departure from previous governors. He is a product of Watergate. He is a product of Vietnam. He was a McCarthy delegate, I think, in 1968 at the Democratic Convention. He is a young Turk. He is a young, very strongly spoken man. He's 36 years old at the time of the election. He's 27 years younger than Ronald Reagan at the time of the election, Dave. Gavin Newsom is 29 years younger than Jerry Brown, finishing up his last year as governor. A 29-year difference, and generational politics is fascinating in this regard, Dave. California has had one baby boomer governor in its entire existence. We're on our fourth consecutive boomer president. We've had one boomer governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, born in 1947. Otherwise, Jerry Brown was born in 1938. Gray Davis was born in 1942. Pete Wilson born in 1933. We've had wartime or pre-war babies. Now California, if Newsom's elected governor, Dave, goes from pre-war through the war years all the way through the boomer generation. Newsom born in 1967. He's a Gen Xer. He is the Jan Brady of American politics, the neglected middle child of American politics. But he's an Xer, Dave, who's really running as kind of a millennial. He's giving speeches where he references hip-hop artists, and he's talking about single-payer care. And it's his platform. I don't mean to filibuster on here, but the platform is fascinating because California has not seen this in modern times from a guy who's likely to win in terms of single-payer care, in terms of universal pre-kindergarten, in terms of free community college. It is really cradle-to-grave government coverage. And the question, Dave, is, well, he'll probably win because there are just that many more Democrats. Does he have happened to him what happened to Brown in 1974, who had, it's the Watergate year, great time to run as a Democrat. He had a double-digit lead all summertime long, but in the final week of the election, his stock started tanking, and each day it would go down a point. He won by 3 points on election day. I don't know if Newsom would be as close as 3 points, but I do wonder as we get closer to the election and people take a closer look, they think, he's slick, he's young, is this maybe a little too metrosexual for us, a little too progressive, a little too hip?
Well, a four-letter word comes to mind when you started that. It's not the four-letter.
We should probably qualify, by the way, that you at one time taught Mrs. Newsom, right?
Yeah, I did. But the four-letter word that comes into mind is math.
Math.
And I remain amazed that people continue to campaign mm-hmm. on these issues. Medicare for everyone, we're going broke.
Right.
Medicare will probably be broke in 2 to 4 years. We do not have the money for Medicare. We don't have the money for free tuition.
Right.
That money. And the worst thing in the case of California is California, more than any other state, is dependent on investment tax credits.
Right.
Up to 25 to 30% of the budget. So if there's a downturn, mm-hmm. at any point,
right.
California's budget drops 25%,
right.
and there's nothing you can do about that.
Right.
Because if people aren't making the money, then they're not making the money. So I do think it's a campaign issue. I don't see this affecting Democrats yet. I don't see anybody starting, but that's what campaigns are about, to
right.
push back on exactly those issues. We'd like to do that, sure. Who isn't in favor of universal health care? Who isn't in favor of free tuition? I'm in favor of everybody having everything they want at no cost, but
right.
that's not economics. You can't have it all. So the question yep. is, what are the trade-offs?
The young Jerry Brown in 1975, 1976, he's running for president in 76, Dave. He gets elected in 74, sworn in 75, and a year later he's off and running. And he advocates what's called the politics of austerity. And what Brown is doing is he's going around and he's splashing water in people's faces. And he's saying, look at California. My God, look at everything that we offer people in the way of government. We can't afford to do this. And it was interesting because, first of all, he was the rare Democrat to do this. And secondly, he was in very much in stark contrast to his father, the legendary
right.
Pat Ground, who, if anything, stood for the yeah. politics of abundance. So I think it's fascinating to watch the midterm, Dave. The Democrats have done a very good job, especially in special elections, of finding candidates who are tailored to their districts. Connor Lamb in Pennsylvania is the ideal of this. But here's the question. When you look at people who are looking to run the Democratic Party, be the nominee in 2020, who is really outside of the mold right now? They all seem to be kind of occupying the
yep.
same space of they want to cozy up to Bernie Sanders on
yep.
health care, and they want to take away the yep. Trump tax cut, and you know they're very, you know, they're anti-Trump at all times. Who really stands out as something different?
Well, the governor of Montana, who's a reasonable guy, but I don't think he has any chance in that primary.
Right.
I know we're probably running out of time, but one last thing. What's your run on the Senate?
Well, we haven't talked about the Senate, have we? So the numbers are just wretched for the Democrats in this regard. I think there are, what, 9 Republican seats
yeah.
up and 25 or 26
yeah.
Democrat
yeah.
seats up?
Yeah.
Well, you could say, okay, the Democrats could hold and they could pick up Republican seats, but there is one easy seat to grab, perhaps. That's Nevada. Dean Heller is
yeah,
up
that's
for re-election.
The one I have as the one most likely to flip.
Yes. By the way, shout out to the manager of the Bunny Ranch who
yeah.
who won the primaries running for the assembly in Nevada.
Yeah.
Good job, Nevada.
Yeah.
Let's say the Democrats pick that up. That's one. Now they're talking about looking around the country at Arizona. Speaking of, by the way, of a place where Donald Trump might interject himself, they don't have a primary, I think, until August. And there is the Senate primary coming up. Sheriff Joe Arpaio, whose birthday, by the way, is today. Happy
yeah.
birthday, Joe. He's on the ballot. So what does Trump do there? Does he support Sheriff Joe or go with Martha McSally, who's the more, I think, more.
There's
more,
a third candidate.
Right, third
too,
candidate, right. too, right.
right.
So what does Trump do there? So if the Democrats and you're looking to build, you first of all have to find targets. So Nevada,
yep.
Arizona, Tennessee, they talk about Tennessee. You hear some Democrats talk about Mississippi, which, boy, really sounds like wishful thinking to me. There aren't that many available seats out there. But the main thing, Dave, is they've got a hold, and they've got a hold in your Montana. I think they'll probably hold Montana.
I think they'll probably hold Montana.
John Tester's a very smart candidate. Yeah. The first thing he points out is he has a bad haircut, and he gets his hair cut in Montana.
Yes. So I think I agree with you in Nevada. I think the Arizona primary, if McSally wins, I think she wins that seat.
Yeah.
I think as the election goes on, Arizona gets more Republicans. It's the typical pattern. The closer you get the election.
Right.
I think for the Democrats, I think Donnelly in Indiana is in big trouble.
Right.
I think McCaskill in Missouri, thus far the luckiest, along maybe with John Tower, the luckiest candidate in the history of the United States. Won twice in a state that's very Republican. I think given the who she's running against system, I don't think that's going to happen. I think she's very vulnerable. The election in, even though the guy in West Virginia is a good candidate.
Joe Manchin.
Mm-hmm. He also could lose that seat. So
right. And there's Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's going to be close, but she's got a good opponent because they nominated the state representative, and it's a small state, so it's only one. So at this point, if I had to bet, I bet the Democrats, I don't think, take the Senate.
No, I think a more likely scenario is Republicans maybe add a couple of seats.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. If the election, again, we should, for the listeners.
If it were held today.
If it was held today, and right. Who knows what. But the Senate, those campaigns go on in spite of Trump. And so that I think that's probably more, I think they do lose one or two, unless there's some really big event that occurs. And I don't see that coming.
I think the one Senate race that I'm watching, Dave, is Florida.
Yeah, Florida's up for grabs, too.
Because here is Bill Nelson, who is one of the last men standing in terms of Democrats in the Deep South, the Confederacy, to the extent that Florida's really the Deep South. But south of Mason-Dixon line, there aren't too many Democrats left, but he's one of them. And he's a survivor, so he's trying to survive one more term, and he's running against, too, Rick Scott, the Republican incumbent governor. So what's fascinating, Dave, is any time a disaster strikes Florida, a hurricane comes in, watch how fast government mobilizes, because Nelson just does his best to get help. Scott, the governor, does his best to get help. Florida get taken care of like few states do in times of disaster.
Right.
Which also takes us, by the way, into governor's races. There are two governor's races that I think are fascinating. Yeah. One is who replaces in Florida and who replaces in Ohio. And this is for a couple of reasons. Number one, we have to look at the presidential race in 2020, and these are battleground states. But also, Dave, we're getting into the business of redistricting.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why we're having this Congress about a conversation about a wave and what happens is one of the challenges for Democrats is Republicans do a very good job at redistricting. So in addition to only 1 in 14 seats in the House actually being vulnerable, it's even tougher because the map is drawn usually in pretty clever ways. Now, again, California is a bit of an aberration here because California changes redistricting policy and now does it by nonpartisan citizens commission. But in other states, it's still done the old-fashioned way by random politics.
Right. So, the way it used to work was Bernie Grofman at Irvine and I did a study on reapportionment from 1880 through 2000. Mm-hmm. And it was where it was mainly all partisan, not much of the citizen stuff.
Right.
And what happened was it all turned out to be okay, not because there wasn't partisanship. But while Pennsylvania was being redistricted towards the Republicans, California was being redistricted, and you balance that out over the 50 states in our decade by decade and now, so there wasn't much different. But as you pointed out, that has shifted, and you go more to these independent commissions. But those independent commissions, as in Pennsylvania, kind of depends who the court appoints to redraw the districts. So you can have less partisan. But it doesn't mean, and it's a hard, reapportionment causes real problems for what's the fairest way to draw districts. And there are two or three different theories, which are too complicated for us to go into on this show, about how you make sure the district meets the criteria.
Let me get you out of here, Dave, on a final question. I remember back in the 1980 campaign when the Republicans ran a very clever generic ad against Democrats. And what it showed was a very big car going down the highway. It must have been like a big Continental or a big Eldorado, just a big gas-guzzling car from the 70s that aren't built anymore. It must have been 4 tons of Detroit pride. And this car is going down the highway, and it runs out of gas and goes off the road. Sitting behind the wheel is a guy who looks an awful lot like Tip O'Neill.
Tip O'Neill, yeah, he did.
Big white shock of hair, kind of a big nose. You know who it is. Yeah. And the message was very simple. The Democrats have run out of gas. So I ask you, Dave Brady, if the two national parties were to do a generic ad, put on your messaging hat for a minute, what would be the Democratic message? What would be the Republican message?
Well, I think that what made Ronald Reagan successful was that he could think of an ad like that. So when I think about the Democrats, I would think, suppose I'm being paid to consult and say, how do you win? I would begin by saying, well, I certainly wouldn't make it the economy. And I certainly wouldn't make it North Korea. Right. I would try to make it something about where he's weakest, and that is with women voters. And I don't know exactly what it would be, but I wouldn't make it the things that they seem to be focusing on.
So I wouldn't
make it immigration either.
So you would make it perhaps personality based.
Yes, right. I would try and make it about Trump, just like the Republicans made the 1994 about Clinton, where a candidate had started out looking like the candidate in the district, and then he turned into Clinton. And for Republicans, I think the ad should be
stay the course.
The economy.
Are you better off than you were 2 years ago?
I would have some nice car driving down the road and saying, hey, things are going smooth, aren't they? And I'd show the numbers, 3.9% unemployment. I'd show all the ads for jobs all over. I think that they should focus on the economy and try to forget the peccadilloes that President Trump can bring to the fore.
Right. Dave Brady, I enjoyed the conversation. You're about to travel overseas. Represent the country well, please.
Yep, same here. I'll try to do so. Thanks.
Okay. You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Dave Brady and his colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. I am on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @HooverWhalen. That's @HooverWhalen. David Brady is not on Twitter or Instagram or anything. You just have to take my word that he actually exists. By the way, Dave, an early happy Father's Day.
Thank you.
For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is a production of the Hoover Institution. For more podcasts and ideas from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org.